The first recommendation on page 10, the recommendation is to share with the department of commerce to review and master service and emission policy for real estate licensees. The law requiring the insurance passed in 2008. It was effective in 2010. The department established the terms and conditions of that insurance in December 2011. The board did not establish their regulations for insurance until October of 2014. So there's been a time lag in moving this forward, and in there last summer, they had not progressed to the point where they're ready to secure a policy. According to FEC EPL and Vision as a Services Management, the policy has not been obtained due to the overall complexity of the project, the lack of insurance expertise, and the limited time that commissions are involved in the Department of Law and their operating regulations. Not securing this policy essentially removes the requirement from all licensees, thereby exposing the public at risk resulting in various emissions in real estate transactions. The second regulation also on page 10, it would let the investigator take action to ensure cases are active after the investigator completed timely. There were 235 investigations open during the time period we were auditing, which was 36 of those. In 29 cases, we found significant resident activity. Those periods ranged from over 4 months to approximately 4.5 years. And of the 29 cases that we had in activity, a lot of them were closed because of the age of the matter. So not in the best interest of the public. The excessive climax of doing inadequate monitoring and insufficient oversight to ensure investigations were completed timely. Consequently, our concerns are not may not have been adequately protected from incompetent and unlawful licensees. But the Department of Health Commission generally concurred with our recommendations.
After you prepare an audit, do you meet with the entire commission or do you meet with the chair? And how do you communicate the findings and what specifically what response do you get if some of these findings are not positive for the public? To the chair, we do communicate during the audit if any issues come up with the official board chair. We have a formal exit meeting describing those findings, and then we send what is called a management letter to them, which is essentially a draft of the report. That's to both the board chair and the department, and following the determine whether they feel anything is inaccurate or incomplete, and gives an opportunity to provide additional information. Then we provide the freedom of report that they need, and then they're allowed to, they think the board and the department are allowed to formally comment. So there are formal comments on the report. Are included at the back of the audit, and the board chair does comment on both recommendations as does the department.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you. Yes, question. I guess it was after all of said and done, where are you right now on a recommendation of how long the board should be extended? 2 years, 4 years, 6 years?
Through the chair, we issued a 4 years instead in order to carry out the policy. Given that in the cost of time it takes to go into the audit, so if we were to come back in 2 years, we would be doing work next year, basically on the audit. At that point, we didn't know some of the information that we learned during testimony. So, I think we're longer period, 4 years, but we are okay with what's proposed in the bill of 2 years.
And the summer letter, if we were to approve the 4 year session, what would that mean to your organization? What would the audit be supposed to be for you? Would it be those 2 years, or do you maintain a constant auditing process?
Our audits are currently now, we are made up mainly our responsibilities to audit states and financial statements and federal programs and the backup workload. And sunsets, which are statutorily required, so that's we are required to do those. And then if time allows, we record performance audits requested by the committee. So sunsets are always done first. Next year we'll be working on 10 of them. It's a very big year. This year we have 4 or 5 of them. So it all depends on the year.
Thank you.
experience in the bill that we passed a few years ago requiring audits from the departments, is that also related to your workload?
My workload, but not the auditor's workload. We had we're given PCS to interview and for interviews, and we're allowed to take time to supervise those and work with the spokes and reports and whatnot. The audit staff are removed from that process. And that has been a deferment for the same thing going forward.
Thank you very much. Any further questions from this board? Thank you. Appreciate it. Next, I would like to invite Sarah Chambers, the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Welcome, Ms. Chambers. If you can provide your name and agency for the record. Thank you. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Division of Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Ms. Chambers, could you give briefly the status of the commission in terms of its operating in the red or the black, and also could you comment on some of the findings in the audit?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. As we know, when you see the sunset rules, there's always a period of time after the audit has been completed where activity happens. We have an opportunity to work for the audit, which is a process that we sincerely appreciate and take very seriously. So we have seen this real estate commission, they are currently running a surplus. They, several years ago, had a deficit that resulted in a few licensing fee changes, and they've since been recovered from that. The surplus, in fact, they actually reduced a few of their fees recently. That seems like it would be reasonable to do. So they're in a very strong fiscal position. The two recommendations that will just be brought up for attention were the most presidential errors and research policy, and then a finding that we have seen in the last several of our legislative audits, including the audit of the Indian Cultural Services Board, which is just before this committee, which deals with investigations. We are, and have been, since this topic came up a few years ago as a recurring theme, have really made strides in investigations unit. Part of this was due to a management change, requiring a chief investigator who then proceeded to immediately make some changes and structural changes to reduce the chief investigator's supervisory workload from 18 to 1 ratio to 7 to 1 ratio. That improved caseload management. We are also seeing a level of engagement and professionalism between the RMLC unit and the Real Estate Commission to reduce the number of investigations, provide more efficiencies, reducing that timeline that you've heard us talk about over the last couple of years. In 2015, there were 116 total cases, only 36 of those were investigations. So we have sort of walked hand in hand with the commission over the last 2 years to really look for better processes to address investigative findings that we had seen already with the audits, but things that were of concern to the commission that, again, we took very seriously and responded to them. Lastly, errors and omissions insurance, it has been a sticking point, if you will, for the commission. The Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, as well as the Administrative Services Division that houses our procurement department, the credit union, and there was a delay, the initial delay in errors and omissions insurance was getting guidance from the Department of Law. That was a significant delay of approximately a year. And then the delay in trying to understand how these pieces work together continued. Both the division and the commission had to adopt regulations. And in 2014, the commission completed their portion. We worked together with the division of insurance to come up with a plan to try to
meet the city. We went out last November for a public invitation to bid. So we did complete the process, invited insurers to bid, and received no responses. Of the two comments I have asking, well, why did not want to know this? We received comments back that the structure of providing airline emissions insurance was not attractive to these insurers because they could not assess their risk. They had no information on the risk pool that was being presented to them from these brokers and insurance people. And the amount that the budget had set in the regulation for an annual premium that would be the cap of what our salespeople and brokers would pay was not attractive in the current market. It was set at $300, and that was far below what any insurer was interested in entertaining. So at this point, we are actively again going back to working with the Real Estate Commission and our various sister agencies to see if we need our regulations change to increase that amount. We need to bring in a expert contractor to sort of pull the pieces together. We're working together with the commission to try to discern what the next steps is. We did meet our goal for this time frame responding to the audit, but didn't have the outcome that we were looking for. Thank you very much, Ms. Chambers. As Senator Stevens.
Thank you. From your perspective and with your college background, can you give us an idea of how often you thought we have insurance coverage for errors and omissions?
Through the chair, I have some of the seasons. If we need to have regulations, which it sounds like we probably do, in order to meet that premium, to raise the premium, to raise the cost to our licensees, then our regulations project of that scope can take, on the general side, 4 or 5 months. It could take longer than that, depending on the various moving parts, but we know that it would be a pretty simple, simple fix. If there are other elements that are needed, such as research to assess the risk pool, provide other data to make this more attractive and practical, that's what we are now, is assessing that. So within the next year, I would hope that we would have a plan together and see the fruit of that later, whether we end up with a successful policy or not. I do want to point out, I think it's important that the E&O policy itself is not required in statute. It's the Real Estate Commission may adopt this policy. However, as Ms. Chris pointed out, there is a clause in the statute that says that if the Real Estate Commission does not have an E&O policy, no one else is required to carry E&O insurance. So the issue is not whether the Real Estate Commission is not performing the statutory duty, but there is a roadblock to the ultimate goal of the errors and omissions element within the statute. Yes, through the chair, Senator Stevens, all brokers and real estate salespeople will be required to hold the insurance. We were encouraged to see legislative audits recognition to give enough time to go through the process, recognizing all of the work the commission does and the importance that they, the approval that they are successfully bringing in our community. We'd like to have the opportunity to see that through, recognizing that it was of immediate importance and is long overdue. We certainly would work with the time frame as it is stated in the bill, but having a little bit longer time to do it might be more efficient and effective.
Thank you.
board of questions of committee members. Chairman, the current guideline, the main guideline of the Real Estate Commission is based as Ms. Maddox said, the authority of the licensees, but there are 7 rules instead of 5. So I double checked on my phone and it's a secret that you want to know the records of 7 or something. Thank you. Appreciate that. Next, I'd like to open public testimony. Ed Martin, you're calling in from Cooper Landing. Could you please provide your testimony in case you talk to the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it is Ed Martin from Cooper Landing, Alaska. Your standing this committee is like something handy to me. I suppose it has a purpose and there's a good reason to. I believe we've got, 120 or 30 committees across the state thousand to make sure that the legislature for all kinds of purposes when it comes to creating regulation. This is an advantage for you folks to, we agree the laws instead of reviewing the regulations, but as in any case, I believe that they should be held to a minimum. I believe that they've got the money in the account from what I see in testimony. The elements are what they are, and we folks should act in recognition of them. And to the benefit of all of Alaska, encourage that we continue to sell lands in Alaska and put these people to work. In any case, not necessarily that board, but I'm just reminding you that I don't know how many of you have come up for how many of these commissions, but in any case, it's not like these folks are doing a job. I would just wish that you keep it to a minimum. This is an expense to the state, and I believe right now you guys are working as hard as you can to keep those costs down, and it's really appreciated.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martin, for providing testimony. Next, I see Cheryl Chambers are here in the room for questions online. Is that true? Okay. If you have any questions, please raise your hands. Thank you. Next, we have Tracy Berkman, who's going to be last in the Real Estate Commission, coming in from Mount Sue.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing my testimony. My name is Tracy Berkman. I'm representing the Revised Real Estate Commission. On behalf of our chair, Nancy Davis, who is at Giveaway on Medical Emergency. I have been licensed for over 23 years and approximately 16 years as a broker or associate broker, everything and supervised thousands of transactions and numbers of licensees for a commissioner for the Real Estate Commission. I'm an educator for about 18 years and I've licensed these brokers throughout the state and I serve as a subject matter expert for Pearson Deal. In support of the standards for the Real Estate Commission, as we operate well within our budget, licensing fees adequately cover costs, the operation costs of the Real Estate Commission, and have a place in the Real Estate budget. As a commissioner, I work with the state investigator to review complaints against the commission as a result of a real estate transaction or licensing interaction with members of the public. Most of those complaints are filed and have a legitimate foundation. In many cases, licensees have been disciplined through education, fines, and sometimes suspension or revocation of their license. Without that process, the only resource for the public would be litigation. In some cases, where licensees have violated the law, a consumer may not have the resources they require to take their complaint to court, and therefore be improper. Excuse me, we're allowing proper or illegal actions of a licensee to continue, which is not being public's best interest. By law binding and adopting regulations, the Commission constantly improves our industry practices. It takes consistent work by the Commission to keep regulations on track with the constantly changing real estate industry. The recent testimony from last year did conclude that the REC, this is just reiterating what the other ladies have already said, they concluded that the Commission is serving the public's best interest. The review did conditionally recommend extending the termination 4 years within an extension, and one item was the vendor, obviously, which we spoke a lot about, the insurance. One problem was trying year or 2 years even, is that even if we were to get that master policy within the next, even if we were able to obtain one within the next 6 months, I don't think that's possible. So I'm not an insurance expert, but from what I'm finding out through all of this is that that's probably going to be impossible because they don't have historical data that they need to even submit their RPS. So keep in mind that real estate professionals have access to consumer loans to terminate commission or budgets, and it would be taken away an important guardian for consumer protection. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Thank you, Ms. Barrett. This is Lena Postel. So the errors and omissions policy is recommended in a previous audit that come online. I understand that given the 2 additional years, that would be challenging because of the lack of the data.
I think that you are here. I feel that it's going to take them 2 years because they, from what they're telling us, from my understanding of this, is they can't submit their ITB, I think, because they don't, one thing with the loan premium is that that's something that could easily be changed, but then they're going to be looking for the historical data, and they don't have it, which I'm not quite sure that I understand why. But there are many brokers in the state that already have it. And in what the commission needs to initially make a motion to release paragraph E on section 172, that's 8.8.172, subparagraph E. And I'm wondering that if we could take that away, then that would require all brokers in the state to have their EO, and we take away that net, and it's just on the master policy, that paragraph that says that they don't have to have it if we can't do a master policy, but we can't do a master policy, and then there's no historical data.
Senator Stevens.
Again, I apologize, Mr. Ryan, not about your business, but so are you saying most your small and real firms that you do carry the assignments and also the state insurance are not the commission does?
Yes, sir. Mr. Stevens, yes. They do a lot of brokers. I have been a broker. I'm currently in a separate brokerage firm in an office, but our brokerage does carry it, and of course, I've always carried it. There's always a tenant broker and a large franchise broker.
Is there any reason to have a requirement of the commission there in the master policy.
Well, Senator Stevens, it's my understanding that there is no statutory requirement for the air emission policy. Would you like to bring up, let's see.
I appreciate that. I'm going to bring up, sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers.
My office is totally the master policy that we have, but the public should be protected on the broker if you didn't pay me that master
policy. Thank you. Here's the record, Sarah Chambers from the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the way it's going to read right now is that all licensees, the brokers and salespersons must carry various emissions. However, they are exempt from the requirement as long as the Real Estate Commission does not have a master EIO policy. So the EIO policy is a triggering event. Once the commission creates a policy and makes it available, then everyone under their governance must carry the EIO, whether it's privately or through this master policy, without the caveat that the commission must have a policy in place about the exemption. If that were to go, then everyone would be required, as is contained in statute. My understanding is that another bill is moving forward that would take that exemption out, but that bill's not at this point. Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chairman. Can I receive that?
No, sure, thank you.
Thank you, I appreciate it. Any other questions of committee members? It is still open at this moment. So its next stop is the finance and that is Senator Kiesel.
I'm sorry, I move House Bill 290, which is 2-1345, that's a full scale of energy recommendations and such. So,
okay, can I take a break, please? Is there any objection to moving House Bill 290? Okay, seeing none, so moved. I think everybody is on the audience. Thomas, please call back to order, and I'm going to next hear House Bill 234, which has been introduced by Representative Liz Bassett, and her staff is here, and we have also been welcomed. And tonight, let's hear from the sponsor, hear from the administration, hear from us questions, public testimony, and schedule aside for the review. So with that, Ms. Hudson, please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and bring up any bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. My name is Leah Hoffman. I am a chief of staff for Representative Liz Vasquez, and I would like to do a brief introduction of House Bill 234. It is a bill that seeks to recover health care insurers offer and offer issue or renew health plans in the state of Alaska to reimburse for telemedicine, mental health services, provide the necessary services in the state of Alaska using Alaska or secure phone or internet video applications. This legislation would not require an initial face-to-face visit, but it does require that providers be licensed in the state of Alaska to provide this service. And that is pretty much the bill. It is a parity bill. Right now, there are 32 states in the District of Columbia that currently have telemedicine or telehealth parity bills. There are laws that require for telemedicine. There's only one state that currently requires a face-to-face encounter before mental health can be delivered via telemedicine, and that's the state of Arizona. And that is simply the nature of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. So you mentioned that other states don't
a lot of face-to-face interaction is not really an issue in other states, but it's hard to imagine how that is going to be a question. In another telemedicine bill, where we talk about all that you can be about being in front of the patient, and I'm just curious if you could comment on that.
Yes, I'm sure that's a good question. And what is important about this particular piece of legislation is first to remember it's an insurance mandate that the insurer does not place a face-to-face requirement on the delivery of telemedicine. There are ethical guidelines, and in the House bill, one House that introduced some ethical standards and guidelines for the delivery of telemedicine, which did talk about ethics and guidelines for the practice of medicine. It is absolutely appropriate for a mental health professional that deems it appropriate to require face-to-face encounter to still establish that requirement. This bill in no way changes the mental health profession's obligation to limit the practice and make that decision. We merely are attempting with this piece of legislation to not allow the insurance industry to impose that requirement. But by all means, if mental health professionals deem it appropriate to require a face-to-face encounter before they deliver, that needs to be a practice decision made by people who are subject to that practice. And that was the intent of not requiring a face-to-face encounter.
So, maybe for that clarification, so what you're saying is that as far as the reimbursement and the paperwork between the insurance company and the patient, that there's no checking by the insurance company whether or not both of these things are actually is handled after that information.
That is correct. And of the 32 states that do require a medicine be reimbursed, only one of them requires a face-to-face encounter for the insurance mandate piece of this, and that's the state of Arizona.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vasquez, we just had your bill. Are you concerned if you had any comments before we move along to hear from the administration?
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, this bill provides access to medical care that is going to be very difficult for individuals to live in outlying areas in the bush. But as recently as several weeks ago, there were news articles about citizens or residents living in Fairbanks having to be flown in for medical psychiatric treatment, mental counseling treatment, being having to be flown into Anchorage because there were no providers in Fairbanks area. So even in another town or city as large as Fairbanks can have access issues. It's also, we take for granted mobility. We have elderly citizens, handicapped, disabled individuals that making a trip to the doctor, to counseling, whatever, is a great hardship first. They often have challenges with regard to physical transportation. Second, when they're able to get transportation, it often takes almost the whole day. Third, walking expended a certain amount of energy and stamina in their everyday lives. Most of these very elderly folks that do not have the stamina we have to spend even a half a day dealing with transportation and medical providers. So, it's a really handicapped for them. Very much challenging and to physically go to a medical provider's office. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vasquez. Just another reminder, I have a constituent whose son was at API when he came home. He was not willing to go into the doctor's office for renewal of his prescription, and he was on Medicaid or Medicaid. I guess also kind of on Medicaid recipients.
Actually, Medicaid has been allowing telemedicine, and they have, it's nationally recognized, they have the gold standard regulations for, with regard to Medicaid, we already do it.
So, the problem that she had was that the doctor was not willing to leave the office to come to the home because transportation is not reimbursed. And you're saying that a phone call to the doctor would suffice?
Could be in that situation.
Okay.
This bill does not have to manage the medical
discussion of basically methods, people's illness, and of course, the different boards, the side boards, and what they want to allow or disallow, and we don't want to get them to deal with medical practice, if you will.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
I know the ANTC and the health organization does a lot of telemedicine. Do they include guidelines that you want to directly relate to this talk to Congress? Do they include the health issues that they deal with telemedicine, or do you know the answer to that?
I believe they are dealing with health issues, but
telemedicine.
Those Senator Stevens, to the chair, my understanding is that the tribal facilities have some federal exemptions under federal law, allowing them great flexibility in the use of telemedicine. Alaska introduced regulations for Medicaid 3 years ago, and a lot of those beneficiaries are dually eligible. And so they have two access points. And so there is a parity issue in the private sector insurance industry versus the publicly funded individuals. Publicly funded individuals do not access to these kind of services by regulations and federal exemptions for many, many years. However, the private sector is falling behind. We have introduced, for the record, a 50-state analysis document. It notifies Alaska has an A-plus when it comes to our Medicaid policies with regards to telemedicine, and sadly, we get an F when it comes to the private sector. This particular bill is the first of what should be moving from that helps move that needle and improve our status on a national level with regards to opening up access for people that currently don't have that access.
I think that many colleges study my district, but there's only a few others around the state where Suzanne is the lowest level. And apparently, it seems to me that it doesn't make any of the preparation for our aid, which still receive services. Thank you.
Well, I just want to comment on Senator Stevens' question. Yes, he also gave a federal health consortium that's related to mental health services to adult medicine for a long time, but I believe the mission has been the highest successful. If I find out that sometimes they use contractors of other states to provide those health care, those mental health services.
Thank you very much, Senator Hazel. Thank you. I appreciate you introducing the bill. I'd like to invite the Steve Utah Board and also Brian Ringhire with the Division of Insurance and his store is with, excuse me, Steve Utah is with the Division of Behavioral Health.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lori Langhire. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the state of Alaska. 234 is very much, as it was described by the sponsor, it does provide telemedicine. Currently, we know that Mona provides for business policies, but Premier is a large insurer, does not include the majority of its plans. We have worked with the sponsor on some areas of the bill that is drafting, and we do not have any comments on. Thank you, Inclusion Subcommittee members. Thank you very much. Ms. Turner, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Turner.
Thank you. And could you introduce yourself to the committee member of the division and also provide any comments that you would like to know about?
Absolutely. I'm speaking from the division of the Behavioral Health Deputy Director, and we are to support this bill. It's very important for us to have what we need to term telehealth services, and especially mental health services in the state. The tribal organization under our services in the state has much village residents access to psychiatrists and mental health professionals. Many of them can't have what the villages are dealing with.
Thank you. Thank you. any questions of community members? Is anyone else online? Again, thank you, Dr. Evans, for calling in. Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify on the bill? Anyone else in Zoom who wishes to testify? Public testimony is now closed. Thank you, Representative Vasquez, for bringing this bill before us. We decided to sign from the review, and we'll take a look at these. Welcome back, Senate members of this committee. So finally, our final bill of the day is House Bill 372. It's introduced by the House Labor Commerce Committee. We have Representative Wilson South here, President Jackson, to introduce the bill, and also the Division of Insurance Director, Lauren Winkler. So my intention is to adjourn the meeting today at 3. However, I do know that we do have one individual here in town who wishes to testify, so in about 5 to 3 hours, Mr. Donnelly to come up and provide his testimony. We both just want to open and if we need to have some further hearing, depending on how far we get in the time that we have remaining. So with that, welcome, and please feel free to introduce yourself and introduce this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. House Bill 372 is insurance omnibus bill making numerous statutory changes, and sure as some of the bills that come before us for many precious years. The bill is at the request of the Division of Insurance, and it's been in the works for months over a year, and actually, it was quite a large bill at this point. It started in excess of 100 pages. After that period, you can thank the director and saving everyone a lot of time. But the bill makes conforming changes that brings us into compliance with the originating federal insurance laws and updates, which updates that are very important to resolve the key that federal preemptions and modernize several provisions in 2021, including consumer protection and insurer licensing restrictions. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll just end my statement at this point and pass it over to Director Winhire. She can walk you through the session much quicker and a lot more clearly than I can.
Thank you very much, Ms. Winhire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the record, my name is Lori Winhire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Before you begin with HB 372, CS for HB 372,
Again, the discussion I have is Section 1, that's okay, in the interest of time. Section 1 was amended yesterday on the House floor, and what this does is it requires that in the annual report, we provide a little bit more information on the number of complaints or calls we had regarding the individual market of health care insurance. It also asks that we report our efforts on how we improve access to the individual market filings. As you know, we've experienced a rate on a good more than 40% for the last 2 years, and the sponsor of the amendment was concerned that we provide more information on the number of complaints last year. We did that in the annual report. We received 13 comments, but we will make sure that it is identified completely that they're related to the individual market, and we will charge the improvements we make to be more open to as far as releasing information before the policy is adopted. Section 2, this is just a modernization. We used to call it the NEIC, the Examiner's Handbook. It is now referred to the Market Conduct Examiner Handbook, and we're simply changing the terminology. Section 3, again, it's just changing the terminology. Section 4, this is a bit of a change. I hope you will agree. We are required, as mentioned, to examine reinsurance brokers, managing general agents, third-party administrators, and most of the time in Alaska, these are very small firms, locally owned, two or three people working there, and we charge them with the time of the division, we charge the travel, we charge all the profit expenses. In some cases, the cost to do this examination was more than the income to the firm. More than a profit. So we could do the examinations. So what we're saying is we're just going to charge this through licensing, we're collecting the expenses of the division or the salaries, we're just going to charge the out-of-pocket expenses to do the examinations. Because we shouldn't stop doing the examinations, but we definitely have the expenses in real estate for a 2-3 person shutup. So we're just amending the statute to go back to where our out-of-pocket expenses are, and while we're not collecting and taking these. Section 5 through about 10 or 11, we are asking through this bill to update the statutes to give us a federal preemption. This particular wording, the various parts of the next few sections are taken from three model bills of the NAIC that have taken language from the Affordable Care Act. The NAIC bills, of course, have been vetted through the NAIC, which consists of the commissioners of the various states, the medical community, public providers, the public, and the other regulators, the federal regulators. So that these have been well vetted, but this is basically to get us out from federal preemption so that we have our own laws. This will also be a regulation project for us in addition to changing the statute. And this, majority of this has to do with utilization review and benefit review determination. So it's consumer protection. And I'm happy to go through each one of them, but these sections, that is what this is doing. That's what these three model acts are doing. These book is combining with what the Affordable Care Act said consumers are entitled to for benefit and utilization review.
Mr. Chair, I think that will be sufficient. If committee members want to go into full detail in our meeting tomorrow, then
absolutely. Okay, this is section 13. 13 and 14 were updating our statutes to comply with amended record keeping requirements. I'm sorry, my apologies. That too is part of the Affordable Care Act, and we did add that into statute, but that is also in compliance, or I should say, to comply with the federal Affordable Care Act, and it's out of the preemption. And that, I'll be filling in house later in Congress. We did a readout as it went back and forth between the providers and consumers. There was a question about newly approved lay person, and we did insert that in working with the providers in the state. But in section 13 and 14, again, this is amending the statute to modernize or update proper PV requirements on insurers who are domiciled in the state of Alaska. Section 15 is just updating the definition of memory and transportation insurance. Our definition was quite outdated. And it was not, but this one particular is working with the drafting error that we found in basically four paragraphs last week. Sections 16, 17, and 18 are licensing. Updating and licensing, we need to provide compliance officers so that you can have one compliance officer for each and every authority. And section 16. Section 17 is amended to make sure to make clear that the authority of the director to adopt regulations establishing education or additional education experience required for seeking providers. In particular, we are trying to get across is that to teach continuing ed in the state of Alaska, the continuing ed provider had to have continuing ed. And that is what we're developing. Section 18 is to require a licensing report to director and changes in the compliance officer. Section 19 is just a market to give the director authority to issue a crop insurance license for a limited producer. Section 20 is just amending what amount of information can be changed as far as a license renewal lapse or reinstatement. And this is 20 and 21, and this is done to comply with our state SPS and our state-based systems with our database, which we get for non-power to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and it's we had the way we were set up currently, we were on one set of statutes that did not comply with the database, and it wasn't a substantial change, but the database said one thing and our statutes said another. So we needed to make just some efforts and very minor changes so that the two systems and statutes and the database complied with each other. Section 23 is third-party administrative qualifications. 24 is operating requirements for third-party administrators. Third-party administrators are adjusters. You may know them or recognize the term better. Generally, administrators are benefit adjusters. Section 25 is operating requirements for reinsurance brokers. They do have to be licensed in the city. And we're amending to add a requirement that domestic insurers, such as Alaska Management, cannot use an alien or an out-of-state reinsurance broker unless the broker is called for certification from the director. Again, it's keeping the solvency and keeping control of the insurer so we're not losing the business to you. Section 26 is just repealing the statute to correct the correct statute, to correct the statute that we're actually referring to. It's a technical change. 27 is amended to remove the authority of the director to adopt regulations to charge fees to those who are not insurers. This amendment is necessary to meet the requirements of the NARA for the non-debate and reinsurance report act of 2010. This means that and it will not be amended to the focus since 2011, so this is just an update. Unless we don't think we have to be included in that we do not. Section 48 is amended again just to remove any reference to the same fee. Section 29 is amended to add claim state to any provision is consistent with power of the 9-pay and reinsurance reform act. Section
three is new, and what this is saying is if there's an association, this certainly can have a group insurance or medical or group life insurance, and they can sell it to others, but having that insurance cannot be what they ask someone to join. In other words, if you join NRA or you join any other association or anything else, very good associations, but the benefits that you join, they ask you to join for, cannot be at all costs. Otherwise, they're broker. And then what happens? They're soliciting insurance. And what they should be soliciting for is the membership of the association.
Individuals who agree to pay each other's medical costs, would that affect
the operation expenses? That is not an association. That is a carve out of the Affordable Care Act and not considered insurance.
Is the actual association defined in the statute?
Not entitled. Well, both associations we do not define qualified viable for the benefit.
Thank you. Can we continue?
Thank you.
And we'll go for another 5 minutes and then have better sort of comments on that.
All right, the next section, we have another section on compliant handling of records, the next section 32. We're just saying that people have the healthcare insurers going to do something else and cancelizing their patient policy over and off covered individuals so everyone or their family doesn't have to get notice of cancellation. Section 33, we're basically clarifying fraudulent acts committed by certain persons. And in section 34, we're also increasing the fine of what we've done, a fraudulent act. Some of these have not been updated in 25 years or more. Some of our companies with $2,500 when we are looking at, but because of some of the acts that we've seen over there are pretty egregious. Section 35 is close to the director of when someone needs to create a license, and you know that another licensee is created by redesign, and you have to see this misrepresentation falls out of benefit for such. Section 36 is something we have been asked by the insurers, 36 and 37, and this has to do with the effective rate date for rate families, the date of filing, and the date that they request to have a filing. So it's just a technical change that we work with all the time, but should not be considered for policyholders. As this 38 having a form, the year of adoption on the form. 39 is the delivery of policy notification, and this has to do with electronic filings and being able to access your policies online. 40 is an amendment just to correct drafting errors on returns and refunds. 41, 42, 43 are related to group contracts, and these next few sections are having to do the next few parts of the bill are having to do. Certainly, life insurance paid for less than was concerned that you were part of a group, and when you left that group and joined, you did not pay for your life insurance policy with you. The transition, they changed our statute basically to allow. This was actually proposed by Senator Packard, he was one of the signers of the bill, and they included it in the end of this bill. So, this is for record. Section 45. Policy to reinstatement of fund policy can be reinstated, but so it doesn't conflict with federal law. Section 46, we don't identify what the health care exchange is. Section 47, we're changing what she said, compensated from DNF, does not compensate, that's a pretty big one in our statute. 48, we're amending it again, this is a technical correction. 49, this is getting new qualified associations. I mean, this has to do with what you were just talking about. We're getting in and then talking about qualified associations. Because it was not defined. And 50 is getting a definition of group health insurance. Section 52
talks about the credibility and conflict between Huntington and the federal law in 1156. Putting away restrictions to disclosures reporting confidentiality or just a technical correction. 56 is 54 is only going to reflect the definition of the association from Gravity 2197 Raymond, which is our definitions. 2155, again, we're conforming with our SBS system. 56 is a drafting convention. 57 is a drafting convention. 58 is a drafting convention for errors that were within our statute. 59 is just saying that an insurance company was not allowed here does not necessarily have to have a stockholder meeting here. And then,
we will go ahead and stop there. Do you have a chance for the staff to review what we've heard so far? We'll continue with the sectional meeting tomorrow, and we will let you know what time it will be.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, I'd like to open public testimony and thank Dave Bellamy, who's here in the studio, to testify on behalf of himself.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bellamy. I'm here today as a private citizen who has been representing my house this morning, you know, as an attorney in Boris Lopez. Just me. I'm asking that the committee had language to HB 315 required that there's an insurance to ensure that uninsured and uninsured insurance policies clearly state what coverage they provide to individuals to insurance as pedestrians and bicyclists. I've submitted some draft language, and I'm not asking for any change to the current coverage. And if in any way this language I'm suggesting might have an effect that the division takes there, I'm very open to any amendments because those are legal. All I want is for someone to be able to read their uninsured and uninsured policy and then know what their coverage is as a walking, as a pedestrian, as a bicyclist. Also, cover my sister was done by a federal director from Portugal, Washington. And after the funeral services, I asked my brother-in-law if I could take a look at their insurance policy, and specifically their UMUI insurance, because I know that typically insurance policies cover you as a pedestrian. And reading his policy, nowhere did it say they were covered. There was any time to provide it for a pedestrian. In fact, it seemed to imply just the opposite. It said this policy covers you when you're occupying a low motor vehicle. And I was very discouraged by that, and I said to Mark, I want you to call your agent, though, and ask if there's something that isn't here. And he did, and in fact, even though the policy didn't say it, there was coverage. And that got me really thinking, and when I got home, I called my state farm agent, and I said, is my family covered under my UMUI, under pedestrians or bicycles? And they said, yeah, we think so. I said, well, where does it say in the policy? I just spent 3 hours reading my policy, but I can't find it anywhere. And they said, really? Well, we'll get back to you. The next day, we got back together, and they couldn't find it either. There wasn't anything in there that specifically said, you know, that coverage was being provided. They contacted National State Farm. The National State Farm confirmed that that coverage was provided, but they couldn't find it in the policy language either. So I contacted the director of the Division of Insurance about this, and I suggested, is there anything in your rules that says that they should say whether or not what coverage is provided in the language of the policy? And she was very nice. She researched it with the NAIC and got back to me and said, we couldn't find any national standard for that language. And I said, well, shouldn't we move ahead with Alaska language then? Just to say that if there is coverage, your person could be able to understand that from reading your policy. And she said, did I make a good point? But that's where it got dropped. And I kind of put this idea on the shelf. And then on yesterday, a day before, when I saw this bill, and I thought, what a wonderful opportunity to honor this bill. This will fix this little glitch for Alaskan consumers. Because, as we know, there have been some very significant accidents around the state where pedestrians, innocent pedestrians, walking down the street have been killed by drunk drivers. and I think you had a bicycle course part of my participation, and I think it would be a really good thing if those families, if they had their UWI coverage, they could read the policy and know that they had coverage in those circumstances. But right now, you can't help by reading your policy. So that's all I'm asking is that the director develop guidelines, and because the director has authority over what the language is and policies in Alaska, to simply have it state what coverage is being provided under that policy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bell. I appreciate
you.
Do you have any questions for
committee members? Senator Warner? Thank you, Madam Chair. So, is it my understanding that there is already such term language regarding, I'm sure, under your coverage policy for the benefit, but it just does not require any insurance to state that in the insurance policy. So, yes, it is indeed 2820445. Has language in there refers to pedestrians and provides the how it's organized and which insurance policy would cover you first if you were injured as a pedestrian, etc. I believe, and I'm sure the director knows, but I think bicycles are covered as motor vehicles because the definition of motor vehicles is a self-propelled vehicle. So I think that's how we get the bicycle coverage. But I'm not absolutely sure about that. I spent the morning over in the library and I couldn't figure it out exactly. But I think that's how it is. My intent here is not to ask for something especially coverage. I just want policies to clearly state if there is coverage, that it is provided. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Perhaps
we can meet with the Assistant Director.
Yes, we can. Something that will happen is we hire responsive when she comes back to the committee. So, with that, again, thank you, Mr. Donnelly.
Thank you for your time.
And I'm going to keep public testimony open. The committee will be meeting tomorrow, and we will be announcing the time. We're listening to this afternoon, so that the committee's announced.